You can have up to 35 sophisticated investors who aren't accredited, but you know them. They know enough about the business world to understand what the documents says and understand what the risk is and make an investment, but you can't advertise. You go over to see, raise as much money as you want.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What is going on, everyone? You know the deal. Every Monday, we're coming at you with some topic on multifamily investing. And today, it's a good one. We got a great guest. This is the guest that's going to keep you out of jail, keep you out of the SEC's eyes. And that is an SEC attorney, a syndication attorney, Gene Trowbridge. Gene's been in the business for a long time. And a cool thing that I didn't know before is he was actually a syndicator himself before he became an attorney. He syndicated for about 20 years. He developed self-storage facilities, I think specifically in California, and sold them to big operators. And then he decided to go to law school, went to law school and became an attorney for SEC and syndication law. So he prepares all the documents for a syndication and keeps you out of trouble. This was a really in-depth, packed with a lot of good information. Definitely something you want to listen if you're interested in, at all in syndicating yourself. And even if you're not, even if you're interested as a limited partner, as a passive investor, I think this is a great episode because we talk about what limited partners should look out for in syndicators, what to stay away from. So there's also some information from that regard as well. And guys, you know the fee. I don't make any money off this. I don't have any ads. So it's simply, if you got value from this show, please share it with someone else who you think could get value. And if you haven't done so already, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That's how we get in front of more ears. All right, everybody, without further ado, here is Gene. Hey, Gene, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, Gene, thank you for coming on. This is an honor to have you on. And I know you're a busy guy, so really appreciate your time. We're just talking about how you're about to go off to Hawaii. So I'm a little jealous on that front, but thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. I didn't tell you one thing. I'm going to run my 37th half marathon. I was in Hawaii when I was 60, and they posted a sign that Kauai was going to have its first marathon and half marathon on Sunday. And I was there on Saturday, and I signed up and ran it. No training, no anything, not the right shoes. Just I kind of got hooked. So I'm running my 14th Kauai half marathon on the 4th, and that'll be my 37th since I started running at 60.
Wow.
At 60, I was running. At 75, I'm run walking with the heavy emphasis on the walking.
That's impressive either way. Congratulations.
But I'll still do it. Yeah.
37. Wow. Wow. Well, I've never done one half marathon, so you've got me beat.
I tried to train for the marathon. My body broke down, ended up with a disc problem in my back and a bone spur in my foot, which required surgery. But after those, I just said, well, I'll just stick with the half marathon.
Yeah, yeah, why not? That's still impressive to me. So that's awesome. Gene, so before we jump into things, if you don't mind just giving the listeners just a quick background on who you are and what you do.
Sure. Love to. Well, you've already heard how old I am, so you know I've been in the business a long time. In fact, my hashtag on my Twitter account is not retiring. Okay. But I came out of college back in Minnesota and went off to the commercial real estate business where I was a broker. And then I started being a syndicator from 81 to 95. I was a syndicator and I actually built storage facilities here in Southern California. We built them, we got them half occupied, and then we sold them to operators. I wasn't interested in being a self-service storage facility operator. I just wanted to build them and make some money from construction. And then in 95, I decided that I'd had enough of that and decided to go to law school. So I went to law school when I was 45 and I've been doing that ever since. So about 20 years of syndication and about 25 years so far of syndication law. I went to law school only to do one thing, to be a securities lawyer. And that's what I've done, Sean. So that's my history. It's a pretty kind of a one-trick pony. Everything I've ever done is related to commercial real estate and, for the most part, syndication.
Wow, that's cool. I didn't know that part of your story about you were once a syndicator. That's one impressive that you've been able to have two 20-year careers. And also, it's really cool, I think, to be a syndication attorney, SEC attorney, but also have the background of a syndicator so you can kind of get, you know, both sides, what syndicator's looking for, and then also the law side. So,
right. One of the things I've done, I spent 40 years as a senior instructor at the CCIM Institute. I'm a lot of a mentor. That's everything cool. I've done in my life has been education-based marketing, and I do a lot of teaching. I get a lot of homework calls from people who are asking, hey, can I do this? Should I do this? And I love those calls, and it's a good business to be in. Being a syndicator is a good business. So if you do it right and we get you started right, that's great.
And if you don't mind defining for the listener, what is a syndication?
That's a great question, because I run into that all the time. I get calls from people who say, hey, I want to put 10 people together and buy a piece of real estate, but I don't want it to be a syndication. Well, that's the wrong question. Putting two people together to do a business venture is a syndication. That's all there is. The question is your syndication a security? So what the people are really asking me is, they've heard about the securities laws and they're kind of complicated. And gee, if I put 10 people together, can I do it without being a security? That's really the question.
Yeah.
And we talk about that. My YouTube channel, I've interviewed a lot of my clients and I always ask them, how did you get in the business? And this is exactly why the people call me. They said they got in the business because they wanted to buy more real estate than they really had the money to buy. So, Sean, you get to a point where you want to buy a bigger piece of real estate or more real estate, and you don't have any more money. So you need to pool. You need to pool your resources and from other people. So that's why I got in the business. That's why all of us got in the business.
Yeah, that's why I did too. So,
sure.
Yep, we all want to scale and grow bigger. We don't have infinite money.
Right. Everything's a syndication. The question is it a security? And basically, the issue on whether it's a security is if you're going to be in charge of someone else's money. You could have two people. You could put up all of the money and take 95% of the benefits and give me 5% for running everything. And if I'm making the decisions, I'm deciding what property we're going to buy, what the loan is going to be, how we're going to manage it. That's a security. It doesn't have to be multiple people. It's all about whether someone is in charge of someone else's money. The government has an interest in protecting people who give their money to someone else to run it,
yeah,
to run their money. So that's what the securities laws are all about, Sean.
Yeah, and I'm glad you made that point, because I feel a lot of people think Gene would just call that a joint venture and they would unfortunately be mistaken and breaking securities law. I see it all the time.
A lot of people teach, well, don't worry about a security, just make it a joint venture. A couple of weeks ago, I had someone call up and they say, how many investors can I have in a joint venture before it's a security? Well, if all the decisions are unanimous, Sean, wouldn't be a security. Even in my example where you put up all the money, you had 95% of the ownership and I had 5. Generally, if I'm in charge, that's a security. But if we had an operating agreement that we're both members of, and we said all the decisions were going to be unanimous so that your 95% didn't make the decisions and my 5 didn't, but we both had one equal vote, we each had an equal vote, and we would have to be unanimous on what we're doing, that would be called a member managed LLC, and no one's in charge of anyone else's money. So it's not a security. But you know, you get 10, 15 people, you can't vote unanimously on everything. So that kind of falls apart.
Yeah, yeah. But that's a great distinction, because I feel most people just think two people is a JV and then anything above that would be syndication, which is wrong. So I'm glad you clarified that.
And even one more than that, you hear people talk about GPs and LPs, general partners and limited partners. Basically, that's a mistake, because we're doing limited liability companies today where there are members and the manager.
Yeah.
LP and LP. But if you're going to do a limited partnership, by definition, it's a security because the general partner makes all the decisions. The limiteds can't vote. And on top of it, the general partner has all the liabilities. So that's a bad deal. But just simply, a limited partnership by definition is a security. So the only way you can stay away from that really is to go to an LLC with a small number of people and you have a member-managed LLC.
And what the Securities Act did was made it so that anything would have to be registered under the SEC, FINRA. However, where a private placement comes into play, which is what most syndicators use, there's an exemption. So if you don't mind kind of diving into that, what is an exemption and how do you qualify for that?
Sure. And when the securities law was passed, they said everything had to go to the SEC and be fully registered. They carved out a section for if you were going to do a private placement, no advertising and just rich and smart people. They said, okay, everything has to be registered unless it's exempt. And what we're working on right now really came out in 1981, Regulation D. Regulation D says, if you follow these rules, it's exempt. You do not have to register it with the SEC. So that's what everyone does. And I'll just tell you the scope of that business. In the last 12 months that the SEC reported, there was over $2 trillion raised in private placements that were exempt. And that's more than the IPOs that were raised on Wall Street in the same period of time. So it's amazing. So yes, exempt is game. That's where the game is. And then there's another issue. You've heard of the blue sky rules. And people say, well, what if I want to raise money from different states? Do I have to apply and work within their rules? Well, Rule 506, which is part of Reg D, we have kind of a flow chart. If it's a security, how do you keep it from having to register it? Well, then you go to Reg D. And if you go to Reg D, you're exempt. But what's next? Rule 506 is one of the rules in Reg D. And 506 says you're preempted from state law. So the state law can't tell you what to do. They need to know that you're raising money from their citizens, but they can't tell you. They can't look at your documents. So exempt and preempted in Reg D Rule 506 is just the easiest way you can be a syndicator. It's really great.
And Gene, what if someone was asked, well, why use private placement and the Reg D exemption? Why not just file a...
Go to the SEC and register. Pay about $250,000 to
$500,000. There you go.
2 years to do that. And well, and what good does it do to you to register? When you register, you can put your offering on the New York Stock Exchange or some other stock exchange. Well, who cares? You don't have any investors. You don't have any money. You don't have a big deal. So you're just much better off staying private. And of that $2 million, and I know you're aware of this, Sean, of the $2 trillion, 95% of that money is raised in 506B.
B. Wow.
So we get down in our flow chart and we're at Reg D, we're at 506. Now we have two parts. Are we going to raise money from people we know, 506B, or are we going to go out and advertise and raise money from people we don't know, 506C? And most of the money is raised in B from people you know. And one of the reasons for that is most of the private placement money in the country is raised through stockbrokers. And they have huge databases, huge Rolodexes, if you would, of investors. And so they don't advertise for new people. So that's where most of the money is raised. And I have some clients who want to do a 506C and want to put a website out there and advertise on their website. That's okay. You can do that. From a marketing standpoint, Sean, you better have a track record if you're going to expect people you don't know to send you $50 or $100,000.
Right, right.
So I'm okay with doing a 506C for any client who wants it, but I'm going to tell them that without a track record, the marketing part of it is difficult.
Right. Yeah. If you don't have that platform already, the people that know, like, and trust you.
Right.
And so what's the main difference for the listeners that aren't familiar with the B and the C? Obviously, you mentioned what C has advertising and B does not.
Advertising is the main difference. In a B, you can take all, you can raise all the money you want. You can have all the accredited investors you can find that you know. You can have up to 35 sophisticated investors who aren't accredited, but you know them. They know enough about the business world to understand what the document said and says and understand what the risk is and make an investment, but you can't advertise. You go over to C, raise as much money as you want from as many accredited investors as you want. No sophisticated investors. You can advertise. But in a C, you have to get a third-party verification that the people are accredited because you don't know them.
Yeah.
In a B, Sean, you know all the people. So I could just check the box on your subscription agreement and say I'm accredited. And since you know me, you would know if I'm telling you the truth or not. If I respond to your ad on your website and say, oh, I'm accredited, here's my money, we're going to have a third-party verification on that.
And that can just simply be your CPA, correct?
It could be your CPA if they do that. There are basically four ways the government says, I mean, you, Sean, you could do it if you asked me for my tax return. And yeah. I showed you my tax return, what my income was. If you asked me for some sort of a verifiable list of assets, a bank statement, stock portfolio or something, you could do that. You could get your CPA, your financial planner, someone like that to write a letter that you're accredited, or it could be someone that you've dealt with before and you've said that they've said that they were accredited and it's been within 5 years and you don't have any information that would lead you to believe that they're not accredited. So, but that's a tough one to do. But most people, you don't want to ask me for my tax returns, do you?
No, I don't want
to. You don't want to do that. So there are companies and the listeners can go on the web and go to Google and Google companies that verify investors' accreditation. And there are all sorts of them.
Yep. And for the listeners that aren't familiar with the accreditation, what it's simply the level currently how it stands is $1 million of liquid net worth minus your primary residence. And then if for income level, this is an or, it doesn't have to be necessarily both, is 200,000 if you file jointly as a single person for the last 2 years with reasonable expectation you're going to do that in the current year. But if you file jointly, it's 300,000. Now, Gene, I've heard rumors that they might increase that.
Well, we've always heard rumors about that. Those are the same numbers, Sean, that they came out in 1981.
Yep.
And I've seen some reports from the SEC that if we just applied inflation, we'd be at a $2.5 million net worth and $750,000 of income.
Yep.
But what did they do last time? Last time they made the change, they didn't change numbers, but they expanded how you qualify. They added something called spousal equivalency. There are all sorts of households in the United States where the two people live there or whatever, aren't married.
Yeah.
But they run the household just like they are. Let's say they're widows. Two widows live together. They both have earnings of $150,000. They're not married, so they don't qualify because you're supposed to, you'd have to have 200 each.
Right.
If they were married, they would qualify. So now they say, well, it's a spousal equivalency, the way they run their life. And there's a definition on that. You add the two $150,000 up and you get $300,000, even though they file individual tax returns, they're qualified. Or one person has $750,000 in assets and the other person has $300,000. Add them together, if the situation is right, and they qualify. So that expanded things quite a bit, I think, as opposed to making it difficult. But yes, there's always an argument that we should raise those numbers, but it hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. And then they recently came out with also if you're licensed under FINRA, you're considered accredited, correct?
Sure. Yeah. If you're a securities broker and you've gone through the tests and you know all this stuff, who cares about how much money you have? You're smart. Accredited was always rich or smart. And so here they've added, if you have, well, like a 65, correct me if I'm wrong, a 7, a 65, and some other one.
63, I think.
Okay. Then you're smart. So yeah. We don't care about your finances yeah. and do that. Well, that's kind of interesting because if I just went out and got my securities license, I'm 25, coming out of college, I want to be a securities broker. I wouldn't have the income. I wouldn't have the net worth, but all of a sudden I have my license.
Yeah.
But you know, if I'm 70 and I've been a securities broker for a lot of years, heaven forbid I'm not accredited.
Yeah, true. Probably in the wrong business.
John, another one that they did, which was good, they changed some wordings. They always said that an entity that wants to invest in your deal has a lot of people in the entity, like a family office, family partnership. They always said if that entity had a net worth of $5 million, it would be accredited and you wouldn't have to go and see who the individual players are. Well, they changed that to $5 million of assets, which expands things.
Right, because it's not net worth.
It's assets, so that's cool. But if you don't have $5 million worth of assets and you have a group of investors together and they go to invest somewhere, the sponsor, the syndicator, is going to have to look at each individual person and see who's accredited and who's sophisticated. And you can only have 35 sophisticated investors in an offering. So you have to be a little careful about that.
Yeah. So how does that work? So if the entity came in and say there was, I don't know, 10 people in that entity, and the entity itself was accredited because it had that $5 million of assets, but each of those 10.
Forget about it. Who cares?
Doesn't matter.
Who cares?
So it doesn't go against that 35? Okay.
No, the entity is a single investor and is accredited. But if the entity comes in and doesn't meet the definition of accredited, and let's say it has $4 million.
Yeah.
And all 10 people are not, none of the 10 people are accredited. Well, then you've got 10 sophisticated people counting toward your total of 35.
Gotcha. Okay. So yeah, it's probably, unless it's a lot of money they're bringing in, it's probably smart to only take in an accredited entity. I also heard over the past, I don't know, 6 to 12 months, they did make a change in the sense that you can start off as a B and then change to a C. Then once you...
Yeah, we've done a couple of those offerings. And so the purpose of that is you can go out to the people you know and see how far you can get in your fund. And when you run out of those people to invest, you can switch and start advertising. So we write the document that says we're starting as a 506B. And at some point, the manager can make a decision to go to a C. You can't do it the other way around.
Right.
You can only do it this way. So they raise as much money as they can as a B, and then the manager is going to make a decision. Well, in our practice, we think the manager has to take some specific action when the offering changes. And so what we do is we file a Form D, an information form, at the end of the money raising of the 506B portion. We've had a 506B, we've raised $4 million, that's over. Then we file another Form D that says, okay, this is going to be a 506C offering, and we're going to try to raise another $4 million through advertising. But the definitive statement is filing the Form D with the SEC, and then, of course, having it in your documents. Now, once you switch to a C, you can advertise, but you can only take people with your third party.
Yeah.
With third-party verification. And if all of a sudden Gene Trowbridge pops up, who's someone you've known forever, and he's not accredited, but he'd like to get in your deal, and you've already switched to 506C, can't take him.
That's interesting. And so you've said you've done a couple now. Has it gone well? The syndicators, is this something they'll do again?
I think maybe we've done four, and I think two of them, they did just raise all the money they wanted in the B. But the other two had a strategy. They wanted to raise some money as a C because they wanted to advertise, they wanted to put their website out there, and they wanted to capture names.
Oh, I got you.
They just want to capture names. And you can capture names, and if they're accredited and they want to invest, that's fine. But if they're not, you put them in your database.
Yeah.
Then sometime in the future, once you've developed a relationship with them, you've built your database, and you go back and do a 506B.
Maybe we should probably touch on that point, the whole pre-existing relationship when it comes to a B. If you wouldn't mind just defining that and how that works.
In a B, there's no advertising and no solicitation. So in order to defend yourself, Sean, as a syndicator, if someone came to you, let's say the deal had gone bad, and someone came to you and said, well, you know, you're trying to do a 506B. I didn't know. You sent a postcard. You invited me to dinner. At the dinner, you handed me the subscription booklet, and I invested. I didn't know
you. Yeah, yeah.
Well, if in fact that investor is found to have come in through advertising, you've blown your exemption. 506B, you're exempt from registration with the SEC as long as you follow the rules. And the safe harbor rule is you don't advertise. Now you have been found to advertise. So now you're in trouble because you sold an unregistered security. So one of the ways you defend yourself is you prove that you had a pre-existing relationship with that investor. And that's pretty straightforward, right? Where in your record-keeping system does it show you, does it show someone who's looking at you and investigating you that you knew Gene Trowbridge before this offering came out?
Yeah.
And that Gene wasn't just in your database. You knew, is Gene accredited, not accredited? What's his investment experience? What's his risk tolerance? You have to have a substantive, and that's, there's no bright line on that. Some sort of a relationship other than just his phone number and his email address. So that's a defense. Now, you don't always have to have a pre-existing substantive relationship. Let's say you know me and I've invested. And then I say to you, well, you know, my brother-in-law in Arizona should invest in this deal. I'm going to have him give you a call. Well, you didn't advertise. There was no solicitation. So you could defend yourself that way, as long as it's a referral from one of your existing investors, or maybe just someone in your database. Maybe I said, well, I can't invest right now, but my brother-in-law in Arizona should know about this and he can invest. Well, you didn't advertise. So you can do that. But we always strive pre-existing, meaning that you knew the person before your offering came out. And my clients, I say that once you sign the fee agreement with me, Sean, your database for that deal freezes.
Gotcha.
Some people say it's the LOI when you have a letter of intent on the real estate, but I don't buy that because with an LOI, I mean, it may never go through. You may decide that you're going to wholesale the property or you're going to keep it.
True.
And what about the purchase and sale agreement? The same type of thing. But I knew when I raised money, I don't know if I mentioned, but I raised all my money from the broker-dealer community. The securities representative sold all my investments. And what I did is I had to go to the broker-dealer and I had to say, here's an offering. And I had to sign a selling agreement with them. And there were two parts to the selling agreement. One, they would do due diligence on my project. And if they wanted to go ahead, they could. And then we outlined the terms of how they sell it and how much they were going to get paid. Okay. And when they signed the selling agreement, the broker dealer community said, you have to freeze your database. By the time they signed the selling agreement, I've done my letter of intent. I may even own the property.
Yep.
And I've done all the due diligence and how many square feet of storage can I build on there and do I have permits and all that stuff. But they counted it when I signed the selling agreement with the broker-dealer firm that that's when I had a contemplated offering. And so your pre-existing relationship has to be before you come out with a contemplated offering. That's a little in the weeds, but that's where we go with that.
It's important, though, because you could create a relationship with someone after that, but that's not pre-existing, so it wouldn't count.
No, and then you put them in your database.
For the next one, yeah.
Yeah, and get to know them, and then your database grows. That's why a couple of my clients wanted to do a 506C. And I actually had a client, it wasn't a B to a C, it was just a C. They were only going to raise $500,000, and they knew where all their investors came from, and they knew that all their investors were accredited. So they did a C, just so they could advertise and build their database. That's fine. That's kosher. That's in the rules. That's okay.
That's smart. I guess, what are some of the mistakes you see a lot of syndicators make?
I think the biggest mistake is trying to do this alone. When I asked all my clients, when I did my YouTube interviews with them, what advice would you give? And everyone basically said the same thing. This is not something you do on your own. It's not a nothing down game with one person. You need a team. And, you know, I tell passives, for the people who are listening who aren't going to be syndicators but want to invest in other people's deals, Sean, I tell them the number one question to ask is, Sean, if I gave you my $50,000 to be in your deal, what would happen if something happened to you? Pretty good question.
Yep, huh? That's a great question.
You better have an answer, or I'm not going to invest with Sean. And yep. So I don't do any offerings where the client comes to me and says, I'm just going to do it myself. Go somewhere else. Because that's when you thought, I have experience in my life where I've been the substitute manager's general partner of seven deals when someone thought they could do it themselves. People get COVID, they go bankrupt, they get divorced, they get sued, they die. There are all sorts of reasons that doesn't work. So then the next thing the passive investor should ask is, have you done this before? And everyone has had to say no the first time, but you got to have some other experience to get by that. Then the third question is, are you putting any skin in the game? Sean, are you going to invest in this deal? And it used to be all we were worried about is the money that Sean's put in the deal. But now with lending the way it is, skin in the game is signing the mortgage. You're going to have to sign a loan. That's a value to the partnership, to the LLC. That's skin in the game. And then the last question an investor should ask is, Sean, if something comes up in my life and I need my money back, are there provisions in the agreement where that can happen? And you'd have to know that. You'd have to answer it. Let's go back to those four questions. Not one of them said, what's a cash flow? Not one of them said, how long are you going to hold the property? I'm not worried about that yet. I'm worried about that you have continuity, that maybe you aren't a first-time syndicator, that you're going to invest in the deal, and there's some liquidity provisions for me. Then I'll look at the deal. So the biggest mistake I think people would make is trying to do this themselves.
I was just going to say, that's a good point. You're not just investing in the real estate itself. You're investing in the syndicator and operator. So it's important.
Oh, that's right. And for my advice to syndicators, this is half people and half real estate.
Yeah.
And I think I'm giving too much credit to the real estate side.
I think you're right.
It really is a people business. Another mistake that I think syndicators make is they don't give themselves enough time to do the deal. And we're in a marketplace right now as we talk where lenders are skittish and they're changing things. If you think you're going to go in and start an offering and raise all the money and close in 45 days, you're crazy. You need 60 and probably an ability to extend maybe 15 days twice.
Right.
I mean, 60 days is tough. Not going to do that. What I find that's illegal, that's a mistake, is using other people to raise money for you, Sean. To make it simple, in real estate, there's a for sale by owner rule. I can sell my own house without a real estate license, but Sean, I can't sell yours.
Yeah.
In the syndication business, in the securities world, it's called the issuer exemption. I can sell the securities that I bring to the market, that I issue, but I can't sell the securities you issue unless I have a securities license. So anyone comes up to you, Sean, and says, you know, I've got some guys, I think we could put $1 million in your deal. I'd like you to pay me $10,000 and I'll bring them in. You've got two problems. Number one, if that person isn't a licensed securities agent, everyone's in trouble if the deal goes bad. And number two, the rule is if you don't have a securities license, the language is there can be no transaction-based compensation, no commission. So you've made two mistakes. And if I brought those people to you and your deal went bad, not everyone knows this, but the people in your deal that I brought with in, they could sue me for a rescission. They could ask me for their $1 million back and never go to you, even though it's your deal. Right. I wonder if everyone who's raising money for other people know that fact. And I know the answer is no.
I don't think they do. Obviously, deals are being put together where multiple general partners raise money.
Well, they become an issuer. And that's what you generally you want to be have them in my world. You want to have them be a member of the manager LLC and have a specific job other than raising money.
Right.
And not compensate them. They can, let's say the managing member is going to get 30% of the deal. You can divide that up amongst people, but it can't depend upon how much money they raise. You could give me 10% because you think I'm going to raise a lot of money. And if I don't, I'm going to get 10%, but I won't be in your next deal, right?
Yeah, that's the thing too. It's the percentage you get is that's set in stone because you're not getting compensated for raising the money.
Right. You can't be compensated. So that's rampant. And I've seen manager entities where they've got 15 or 20 general partners signing up. And the agreement specifically says you've got to bring in at least $500,000 to keep your percentage.
And well, they say that on it?
they say that on them. It's totally illegal.
No, wow. That's crazy. I knew it was happening, but I didn't think they put it in writing. That's why.
Yeah, I know. So it's really bad, Sean. So I don't know. Trying to draft your own documents is a mistake. Not reading your documents once you get them and just rushing out trying to raise money without knowing what it says. Because you're going to run into a CPA or an engineer who would like to invest. And by God, Sean, you're going to read the documents. And then they're going to ask you a question. And if you don't know how to answer it, you've lost that investor for this deal.
Oh, 100%. And yeah, my partner is an engineer. Any legal document we get, he reads the entire thing. So one, I'm glad I have him. Two, I know what you
mean. Well, you should. Yeah. We've worked for 30 days to get this document ready and I hand it to you and you run out and try to raise money. You should at least read the final draft. You've read it a couple times before, so it shouldn't take you more than an hour to go through it, but you should at least look at it. Because believe it or not, I'll make a mistake in the drafting of the document. I'll leave some name in there that shouldn't be in there. I'll make a mistake and someone needs to proof my work.
Yeah.
And it's my clients.
And so this document you'll be giving out, for the listeners that don't know, there's a few, obviously, but the main ones are the subscription agreement and the private placement memorandum.
And the operating agreement.
Yeah. And there could be multiple of those too, because you have, depending on how you set up your structure, you have a management LLC, property LLC. And the way I like to look at the PPM is essentially it tells the investor, you know, everything that could go wrong. That's the way I like to look at it. I don't know.
In my documents, when I say, here's how you do this, the first thing you do is read the PPM. And I say right there, this is the story.
Yeah.
Read the story of what's happening. And if you like the story, then you can go and read the operating agreement, which are the rules that we're going to follow to make the story happen. But the PPM is just the story.
Story, yeah.
And we try to write it in as much plain English as we can.
And the guidelines that we have to follow in that story. So once that's created, that obviously has to be signed off by every investor. And it's important, to your point, that they read that too. And you're...
You know how we do it. I don't know how you do it. We don't have the investor sign the operating agreement. We have changed our subscription agreement. So a signature on the subscription agreement attests to the fact that they've read all the documents and they've asked all the questions that they need. And then the lender oftentimes wants to see the signed subscription agreement.
Yes.
So we don't worry about giving them the signature page on the operating agreement and the subscription agreement. So that is shortcut the work that our clients have to do.
That's smart. That streamlines it for sure. Any other pitfalls that you can think of that syndicators or maybe even just limited partners should look out for?
Yeah, I got a million things. One of the things that I see is some syndicators get a little fancy with their waterfall.
Yes.
And they have different levels of changes. And all that does is confuse the investor. The investor just wants to know if it's going to be 80-20 or 70-30. They don't want to know that for a certain IRR, it's going to be this and another IRR. They don't even know what an IRR is. And most times, my clients don't either, but they've seen that in someone else's document. It sounds great. You make the deal easy. Make the deal easy for the people to say, yes, I've got continuity. I mean, I know you like real estate, Sean. I know you know that my part of the real estate world that presents opportunities is building storage facilities that I can sell to Public Storage or some of the other people when I get them done. And here's my team. I got a great guy who can pour concrete till the world's flat. I've got managers. I've got all this stuff. And I know you know all that. So here's my offering.
Yep.
Press hard. There's four copies. I mean, we're done.
Yeah, I think it does get a little muddies the water sometime with the waterfalls. And the only time that I've ever used it is or considered using it is when you're dealing with a more sophisticated investor like family office or private equity, because they'll require it. But I agree. If you're just going after your list of your people, you know that's...
Well, you know, in the institutional world, the deals are 80-20 with a 2% management fee.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the institution. But when you say family offices, they always can be a little creative.
Yeah, they do.
If you're going to just simply take a deal to Wall Street institutions, it's going to be 80-20 and a 2% management fee.
Yeah. All right, Gene, well, I don't want to take too much of your time. I don't know how much time you have, but before I forget, Well, I guess it's right behind you. I was going to say, where can the listeners find you? But it's, if they're not viewing, sure, those that are listening, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, you can go to my website, and the website is trowbridgelawgroup.com. I'd like you to take advantage of my extensive YouTube channel, which is YouTube and then Trowbridge Law. And you can always call the general office, and if I'm in, they'll patch you through to me, 949-570-1507. 949-570-1507. And I'm located in California, but before COVID, my company went totally virtual.
Really?
Boston, Nashville, College Station, San Francisco, LA, and Orange County. And so we do business all over the country.
Yeah,
it's federal law, so we do it everywhere.
In my neck of the woods, Boston, that's awesome.
That's kind of interesting. Tim, who's been with me for 6 years, is our IT guy. And he just decided one day he was going to take the LSAT and did well enough that he got a full ride to the New England School of Law.
Oh, wow.
And so he's still my IT guy, but he's in his second year of law school. And what he wants to do is he wants to come into the firm and be an attorney with us, which is great because, and I'm trying to grow the term with young, the term, the, what's it called? It's called a firm. I'm trying to grow the firm with younger people. My partner right now, Jonathan, is 34. I think Tim will be 36 when he gets out of law school. And I'm a little older and everyone else is younger. So I'm not going to retire for a while, and hopefully there's a legacy firm here.
That's really cool.
That's my goal.
That's a great story.
It's been great, Sean. I sure appreciate you having me on. And there's a million things we can talk about in several months if your listening audience thinks it would be great to hear more from an SEC attorney.
I'm sure they will.
I'll come right back on.
Even if they don't, I want to have you back on.
Okay, so you can call me anytime if you have any questions, and that's fine. We always do absolutely free consultations. If you get to the website, you can sign up for me or Jonathan for a free consultation. We'll be happy to take what I call as a homework call. Before I get into this mess, I should do some homework, okay?
Well, Gina, I appreciate that a lot, and I also appreciate you coming on here and sharing your wealth of knowledge with everyone. I know you're busy, so have fun in Hawaii, and I'll talk to you later.
Good. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and, of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.